This is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, September 13th, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is News for the Rest of Us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we're sharing a clip from the first episode of the new season of the Courage My Friends podcast, Climate and the City. Are we ready? In this episode, host Resh Badu sits down with former mayor of Toronto, David Miller, to discuss the crucial role of cities in fixing the climate crisis and what we can learn in building sustainable and equitable urban communities. Miller and Badu also explore the question of just how prepared Canadian cities are to meet the challenges of this crisis. Here is a short clip from Climate and the City. Are we ready? From the Courage My Friends podcast series.
David, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Resh, I'm thrilled to be here. I love the name of the podcast. I love the idea of the podcast. And I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Well, lovely. So you are currently Managing Director for Urban Climate Policy and Economy with the C40 Cities Leadership Group, a group you actually helped found. So tell us about C40 and its mission.
C40 is a group of mayors of the world's largest cities who've come together to use their action and their voices to help the world avoid climate breakdown. It was started in 2005 by then-Mayor Ken Livingston in partnership with a number of us. The original idea was it would sort of be a parallel to the G20. So it would be the capitals of the G20 countries. Pretty quickly, Ken realized, because we told him, that that wouldn't quite work. And what we really needed is not just the capitals like Ottawa. In fact, we didn't really need the capitals. We needed the world's biggest cities. So in Canada's case, Toronto. So we were a founding member. The idea was the 40 biggest, most important and influential cities in the world, and half global north and half global south from inception. So we moved broader than the idea of the G20 alone. Since then, it's grown to about nearly 100 mayors of major cities in the world: Beijing, Johannesburg, Cape Town, Rio, Sao Paulo, and the like. And the basic membership criteria is that you, as a mayor, have to be a climate leader. And the definition of that is your city has to have a climate plan that you're acting on, and that plan has to be consistent with science that shows we have to keep overall global average temperature rise to 1.5 degrees or less. That's the condition of membership, and the organization has had some amazing successes, although, of course, worryingly, international climate action is lagging on the national side what science says we must do.
Right. And the climate crisis does demand action at all levels of government, as well as intergovernmental action globally, which you say, tends to be lagging behind. But you say that it is the municipal or city level that is most crucial. And having served on city council and as the former mayor of Toronto, you bring particular insight to this. So why cities?
Well, that's always the question I'm asked, because people, I think, recognize that climate change is an international problem. So think, well, there have to be, it has to be international organizations or national governments that lead. And of course, they have important roles to play. But cities have an exceptionally important role, first of all, because most greenhouse gases are emitted either from cities or from the activities needed to support them, like a power plant, even if it's outside the boundary of the city, about 70%. And most greenhouse gases within cities are from four things: how we generate electricity, how we heat, cool, and build buildings, our transportation systems, and how we manage waste. And all of those things have solutions today that can dramatically lower greenhouse gases and actually build better places to live, more equitable places to live, more interesting places to live. So for me, when people say, well, why cities? Well, the answer is that's where the problem is, and that's where the solutions are.
Right. Cities are the center of industrialization. Industrialization is what has essentially birthed this climate crisis. So it would make sense that cities should be on the forefront of resolving this crisis as well. And city planning is quite vital to this, right? I mean, you have the meeting of the mayors through C40, and you're talking about city planning. So could you just go a bit more into that aspect of it?
Sure. Maybe if I can just do a little bit of a segue first, because there's a subtlety about cities as well that is very different than national governments. Mayors are elected to take action. City governments have a whole range of responsibilities, particularly in Canada. I mean, look at what Toronto's responsible for. It's responsible for social housing, administers income support, it's responsible for parks, the urban forest, water. Water management in the sense of stormwater and flooding. It's responsible for transportation. It's responsible for city planning. It's responsible for public health. And there are huge correlations between poor health outcomes because of bad air and the pollutants that cause both bad air and climate change. So cities are very positioned to take action because of the responsibilities they have. And also because of the form of government, it's one that people expect action. They don't put up with a government saying, well, we're going to study this. And in the case of the international community, the international community said, okay, climate change is a problem. And then they took 21 years to come to agreement. 21 years. Everybody celebrated in Paris. But it took 21 years. A mayor would be thrown out if she waited 21 years to act on anything. It's just inconceivable. So the nature of city governments lends themselves to action. And because they have responsibilities that significantly impact on whether we're going to have low impact cities from a planetary perspective, whether we're going to have cities that emphasize equality or produce inequality, their actions are really important. And you spoke to planning. Well, from my perspective, there's huge pressure right now in Canada, the United States, and elsewhere about housing. There's huge pressure to build new housing. I think some of the arguments are misguided, but maybe we can get into that later. But we can build that housing in a sprawl-based fashion, as we've done in and around Toronto since the 90s. Or we can build a dense urban form, loosely called 15-minute cities, although different names are used in different places in the world, basically a city of neighborhoods, densify and build around a city that is walkable, that meets people's needs for recreation, for work, for public facilities like libraries and parks within a very short walk or bike ride or bus trip or streetcar trip or subway trip from their house. That's a choice we can make. And if we build cities that meet people's needs in that kind of dense urban form, we can also build cities that do their part to dramatically lower greenhouse gas emissions. That's a choice we can make. And that's about city planning and cities using the legal powers and the influence they have to make change.
Now, I want to get more into solutions and the book that you wrote on that. But before that, just a little bit more into what we're facing. So, over 70% of the world's cities are experiencing the effects of climate change. Currently, what are the types of impacts that Canadian cities are experiencing? What are some really key areas of concern right now?
Well, cities are literally burning down. I mean, Jasper, okay, it's a town, not a city, but it's burnt down. And it burnt down because wildfires in British Columbia, Alberta, and Eastern Canada are being made worse, more frequent, and the season is lengthening because temperature's warming. It's also wildfires in BC in particular are being made worse because of the spreads of certain kinds of parasites that are harming trees that are spreading further north because the range of insects is changing because of climate change. We're seeing public health impacts of wildfire smoke. Last summer, Montreal and a number of East Coast U.S. cities like New York issued a public statement about the public health impact of Canadian wildfires on East Coast U.S. cities. It's extraordinary to think of that. There was a crisis, particularly for people with asthma or other breathing difficulties, on the East Coast of the United States and the East Coast of Canada because of wildfires in Canada, thousands of kilometers away, which wildfires had been made worse and their likelihood that they're going to happen more often because of climate change. That's a huge impact. Flooding is a huge impact, and it's a very significant worry. If you own a house, and it's most people who are lucky enough to own a house, and my family grew up as renters. I'm actually the first person in my family that I know of to have owned property. So it's a massive investment for people. If you own a house that's flooded, it is very possible that you won't get insurance again. So what happens the next time it floods? What happens to that major life investment that you've made? In addition to that, of course, there's billions of dollars of damages, $1 billion in Toronto from the second last storm alone. And we're seeing storms that we thought would happen every 50, 100, or in the case of Houston in the United States, every 500 years, starting to happen every year. And that is really challenging because the infrastructure that's been built to handle stormwaters, what we call green infrastructure like ravines and parks, and hard infrastructure like sewers, that was all built on the assumption that rainfall would happen in these volumes very rarely. And what we're seeing is not only are storms happening more often and in bigger levels, the rainfall is happening much faster. So you'll get the rainfall in a half an hour or an hour that you should get in a day or a week. And it means the land can't absorb it. So you have really bad flooding. Another really quite serious impact is heat and extreme weather events that are particularly impactful on seniors, low-income people, and other vulnerable people. Really worrying. And then we're going to see, and there's interesting research starting to be done about diseases borne by mosquitoes and other, what they call vectors, vector-borne diseases that are spreading in places where they were never heard of before. And they're going to come to Canadian cities too. So those are all extremely serious impacts of climate change. They're happening today.
Oh,
This
yeah.
isn't what's going to happen in 2050. This is right now as we speak.
Exactly. Every year we're breaking heat records. We're breaking all sorts of records. So it really is right outside of our windows, right on our doorsteps. Now, late 2020 saw the publication of your book under, as you say, the deliberately provocative title, Solved: How the World's Great Cities Are Fixing the Climate Crisis. So tell us about the book and what motivated you to write it.
Well, I was motivated to write it because I've been in a privileged position. I've been the mayor of Canada's biggest and I would say greatest city, although, we'll get comments.
Yeah.
But Toronto is a very special place. It is a city of neighborhoods. It's a city of welcomes newcomers. It's a city where, most of the Canadian economy, about 20% of the Canadian economy, is within an hour's drive of Toronto City Hall. It's incredibly important in a Canadian context. I've been privileged to see through a mayor's eyes what's happening, and I've been privileged to be with C40 cities and see what mayors around the world are doing. And it's amazing. But nobody knew. Nobody knew that story. And when I wrote the book, people were beginning to lose hope that we could actually make a difference on climate. So I wrote it for those two reasons: to tell these positive stories of real climate action, of interesting climate action, of climate action that was working in great cities around the world, and also to inspire people. Because the truth is, we don't need to invent new things, at least to grapple with the issue we have today and get us on a path to solving the problem. What we need to do is take what's working somewhere and do it everywhere. And that's something we can do because that's a choice we can make. It's not about creating some wild new technology. It's about taking the best ideas and spreading them rapidly at scale. So I wrote the book to help people understand that was possible, to inspire them to make change. And it's just come out in paperback, by the way. So that's a timely conversation we're happening in the audiobook. The messages in it are still relevant.
Very relevant. I've read the book. I teach using that book as well. It's one of my resources for when
Thank
I
you.
teach climate.
Thank
You're
you.
quite welcome. And thank you, because when I'm teaching climate, it can be incredibly depressing. And this book, which is very solution oriented, as you say, it casts a really hopeful light on what can often feel like an overwhelming and irresolvable climate crisis. So again, thank you. And my students, thank you too. And it focuses on four key areas: energy, buildings, transport, and waste. And I just want to quickly get into some of those strategies, beginning with transportation. You have long been an advocate of public transit, including from your own time in municipal politics. So what are some examples from Canada, but also other cities around the world, of how transportation can be made sustainable?
Well, Rush, one of the reasons I got involved in municipal politics is because local governments ran public transit. It's always been an interest of mine. And partly, I think, because of my background. When mom and I immigrated to Canada, we moved to Ottawa. We lived in my Uncle Jimmy's basement, typical immigrant story, and until we got on our own feet. And, the next year, my mom got an apartment and we lived there. But we came from England. And the first winter we were in Ottawa, there was 14 feet of snow. So, nearly 5 meters. It was incredible. My mom said, "I'm not driving in this crazy country. How can you possibly drive on these roads?" So we took the bus everywhere. So it's been part of my life since I was a 10-year-old boy. And from my perspective, public transit is exceptionally important to climate change in a whole variety of ways. The first thing is, of course, if people take public transit instead of driving, we've got lower greenhouse gas emissions immediately from transportation perspective. But secondly, and it's a little bit more subtle, if you build a city around public transport, you can build a city that gives people the opportunity not to have to drive. And therefore creates a city that is far lower emissions. So if you look at a dense city like New York, built around public transport, or London, England, or Berlin, or Paris, their greenhouse gas emissions, relative greenhouse gas emissions from transportation, are far less than a spread out, sprawling city like some of the American cities. So it's really important from those perspectives. So what do we see globally? Well, we see, first of all, a really interesting movement to make transit affordable by building and electrifying bus rapid transit. So Curitiba, Brazil, which long ago created busways with stations where you prepay. When you go in the station, the bus comes in, you just get in the bus and it goes really quickly with its own designated right of way. Really fantastic. And cities around the world are starting to catch up to Curitiba, that has been doing this since Jaime Lerner was the mayor, and now adding a layer of completely electrifying their bus fleets. Canada, we're pretty slow. We're still running what are more or less pilots. Brampton's doing some interesting work trying to bring in electric buses. Toronto is pushing slowly. But if you look at China, Shenzhen, China, for example, it has a completely electrified bus fleet of over 16,000 buses. It has electrified its taxi fleet as well. And it has used that electrification not just to lower the emissions from the transportation sector, but also as a driver of employment and industry. And the world's biggest electric bus manufacturer is located in Shenzhen. It's called Build Your Dreams, BYD. Very smart policy connection between future-looking jobs and solving the climate crisis. And we're starting to see now, and this wasn't true, let's say, 5 years ago when there were a handful of electric buses. Today, there's well over 60,000 on the streets of C40 cities alone, a big push for them in Latin America. and a huge electrification of public transport. And the buses are important because buses are relatively cheap. Subways have a place. They're really important when you have really dense built-up cities. Streetcars and light rail have a place when cities are a bit less dense, and buses have a really important place. So we're seeing a movement not just to build rapid transit networks, which really matters because then you can densify your city around it and people don't need to drive, but also to electrify the public transport networks that exist and thereby dramatically, well, eliminate tailpipe emissions and, depending on your electricity grid, quite dramatically lower greenhouse gas emissions as well.
Now, surprisingly, buildings, particularly in our larger cities, are some of the biggest carbon emitters, even outpacing the pollution coming from vehicles, cars, buses, other types of vehicles. So, what are some strategies for curbing building emissions?
You know, it's so interesting, Rishi. I guess buildings aren't really kind of sexy. People can get their head around building a subway. I think they can understand about building bike lanes and walkable cities, and it appeals to people. And we'll get into this later, I'm sure, but you know, solar panels. But I don't think people see buildings for the challenge they are. And the fact is, in many cities of the world, how we heat, cool, and build our buildings is the single biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions. Certainly true in Toronto, it's true in New York, it's true in a lot of places. So, what can we do? Well, the first thing to understand is that most of the buildings we're still going to have in 2050, when we need to be at net zero emissions, have already been built. So, those buildings need to undergo really dramatic energy efficiency conversions. And there's some good examples. Toronto's Better Buildings Partnership, for example, which was actually promoted first by city councillors like Rob Maxwell and Jack Layton quite a long time ago in the late 80s and early 90s, is a partnership between Enbridge Gas Company, downtown office building owners and managers, and the city to reduce the reliance on gas in buildings. And that's really important. In North America in particular, gas is used, so-called natural gas, is used often to heat and cool buildings. Gas is nearly as bad for the climate as coal because of the leaks in the pipelines to supply it. So we need to do everything we can to stop using gas to heat and cool buildings. It's really important. So the Better Buildings Partnership has had really terrific outcomes, and it's been so useful. It's been copied elsewhere, like in Melbourne and Sydney, Australia. So that's one example of addressing existing commercial buildings. A second is in New York City. It's done two things. Under Mayor Mike Bloomberg, it posted the energy consumption of office buildings. And in the best office buildings, the tenants, who were very sophisticated, said, "We don't want to pay for a lousy building. You need to up your game." And the really best buildings, like the Empire State Building, went through huge energy retrofits to dramatically lower the amount of energy they used to heat and cool the buildings and the resultant greenhouse gas emissions. But the more modest commercial buildings, for a variety of reasons, didn't do the same thing. Maybe their tenants weren't as sophisticated. Maybe the owners had a shorter-term view and didn't want to own for the long term. So Mayor Bill de Blasio, when he was in office, brought in a law called Local Law 97 that requires buildings by 2030, commercial buildings, to have their greenhouse gas emissions. And that's important because it's often the commercial buildings that are the biggest greenhouse gas emitters. And it's also important because that's what we all need to do. Global emissions have to be halved by 2030 if we're going to have any hope of avoiding climate breakdown. So it's a very urgent thing. That's 6 years away.
Are we on track? I mean, that's a target. We have the 2030 target, the 2050 target. Could you speak more about that, the targets, and whether our Canadian cities are on track to meet those?
Toronto's on track, but it's stalled. So, when I was in office in 2007, we brought in a climate strategy. It was called Changes in the Air. It passed council unanimously. And at the time, there were 44 members of council plus the mayor, some of whom rarely voted with me, let's put it that way. In fact, deliberately didn't, I suppose. But it was unanimous. And I think that showed, local politics is very local. People are in touch. Good councillors are in touch with their constituents. And I think it showed that people in Toronto expected that their elected officials.
That was a small clip from the latest episode of the Courage, My Friends series on climate and the city. Are we ready? Featuring host Resh Bidou and guest David Miller. To listen to the full episode, please visit our sister podcast, Needs No Introduction, which hosts the Courage, My Friends podcast. Needs No Introduction can be found on Rabble.ca, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. We're coming to the end of our episode this week, listeners, but the last thing we want to leave you with is this. Rabble.ca and the Institute for Change Leaders are proud to announce that we are now accepting applications for the 7th Annual Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellowship. Here to share a bit about her experience with the fellowship is last year's fellow, Madison Edward Wright.
My name is Madison Edward Wright, and I just wrapped up my stint as the Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow at Rabble.ca. As the fellow for 2023-2024, I got to spend 4 months focused on reporting on labor, human rights, Indigenous activism, the 2SLGBTQI plus community, and much more. I was constantly encouraged by my editors to pitch stories, work on securing my own interviews, and be creative with how I approached reporting. It was the perfect environment for me as a beginner reporter to familiarize myself with the functioning of a newsroom, as well as the teamwork required to run a successful publication. Overall, this is a great experience that I cannot recommend to another journalist more strongly. It's a great team and you're going to love it.
To learn more about this fantastic opportunity, please visit Rabble's Jobs and Opportunities page or rabble.ca/journalism-for-change. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.